Austin, NPR News, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
We don't have reliable numbers yet, but hundreds, if not more than 1,000 people in Russia's Ural Mountains have suffered injuries from small to serious after a meteorite streaked through the sky and slammed into the earth. Planetary scientist Clark Chapman says it made a terrific noise.
That was undoubtedly the object breaking the sound barrier and the shock wave. People have heard similar booms from jet airplanes. This was a much, much bigger one and, of course, broke windows over a wide area.
Chapman says scientists may never know exactly how big the original meteor was because since it was unexpected, it wasn't tracked on its way in from outside the Earth's atmosphere. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
Today's programming is made possible by Parkland College Theater, presenting the classic American comedy, You Can't Take It With You, by Kaufman and Hart, from February 21st through March 3rd. Can Alice and Tony's love survive when the conservative Kirbys visit the free-spirited Sycamores for dinner?
And welcome to Focus. I'm Kimberly Cronick. Well, from time to time, we like to provide you with an opportunity to ask some basic questions about personal finance. Kevin Waspy, who lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business, drops by about every other month or every month to answer your questions about money management. Whether you're just starting out and looking for advice on investing, or you have debt and you want to get out of it, maybe you're wanting to buy a home, refinance a home, send your children to college, or you're about to have children, or you're planning for your retirement, your questions are welcome this morning. And Kevin Waspy, welcome back to Focus.
Thank you, Kimberly. It's always good to be here, and it's always nice to have an opportunity to talk with people, not only at the station, but also callers as they listen and have questions.
And we hope you will call in or email us with your questions. You're part of this discussion, and your questions are welcome at 333-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. or 333-9455. You can also send your questions on our Twitter account. We're at Focus580. Well, Kevin, it's mid-February. Most of us should have received by now our tax documents. What are the big changes in tax laws that people will notice this year? What's going to be a surprise?
Well, I would have to say that the bigger surprise is probably going to be already the discovery of less take-home pay. So let me back up just a moment and try to refine what I mean. When we're doing our income tax at this time of the year of 2013, we're actually doing that for the year closed December 31, 2012. So the paperwork that's confounding us at present, or will be soon if it hasn't started already, really will have to do with those tax situations in effect for 2012. Most people have probably already noticed a little less take-home pay because in 2013, we've got a higher withholding rate for Social Security taxes. So what's referred to as the payroll withholding tax has increased 2%. It's actually an increase back to a level that it was at 2 years ago. The past 2 years, 2011 and 12, we were given a little bit of a stimulus, as it was referred to out of Washington, D.C., with a rate that was 2 percentage points lower in that withholding tax. So, long answer to a simple-sounding question, I know, and I apologize for dragging this out. I would say the biggest things that we're noticing relative to taxes are 2013 current year tax rates, as opposed to the 2012 tax implications that we're all dealing with now and filing those returns.
So when we think of this current tax year, 2013, what is your best advice for people planning for this tax year, and be specific about who this advice is for?
Right. That's a great question because the first thing you noted it's going to vary considerably from person to person, and then some of the conditions each of those people find themselves in. Younger people may have different things either to avail themselves to or be cognizant of than people who are more advanced in age. The other thing, obviously, is the conditions of employment. We could start with some generalities and then get into specifics if callers have some specifics. But what I would say is this: it's always good to begin a planning process and set your goals high, reassess those throughout the period, so maybe at midpoint in the year, and then do your best to try to, stick with the promise. Some of those promises or goals might be things related to, let's make sure that we don't overspend our incomes. It seems that that's a tempting thing that many people, have trouble avoiding. So when we set goals early in the year, one of those goals might be related to taxes, related to saving, related to retirement, related to children, related to future education expenses, all of those things. But I guess it boils down to acknowledgement. The money that I spend today is unavailable for any future use. Doesn't that sound simple?
That is. That's great.
The money I spend today is unavailable for any future use. Fill in any possible imagined future use or need. It's not available. So you can tell already there's kind of a bone in my body that has thrifty written all over it. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's not in everyone's body, but I think that's kind of the bias you're going to hear me say, you're going to see in evidence with most of the questions that a person would ask me about planning for the future, whether it's a future wedding, a future planning a family, a future purchase of a house, a future in a retirement setting, whatever it be.
So that's great. So if you are in one of those situations and you're listening to Kevin and me right now, we would love for you to call in and say, hey, I'm planning for this. What's your financial advice? We'd be happy to have Kevin connect with you on your specific situation. 333-9455 or will-talk@illinois.edu, or we're on Twitter at Focus580. Kevin, we were jumping ahead to this year, but I forgot to ask you about the tax returns in this year. IRAs. Is there something we can still do this year that would benefit us in the last tax year?
That's a very good question, because now we have that opportunity to make up for something that maybe we didn't do in 2012 that we'd like to do, or, you know, have the opportunity to, turn back the clock. Basically, until a person files their tax return, they still have an opportunity to make a contribution to an IRA, whether it's a Roth IRA or a regular IRA, for the tax year that's already behind us. So as long as we're filling out our 2012 tax returns, we still have an opportunity to make a contribution to an account that impacts that income possibly.
And I'm going to stop you for a minute.
Sure.
For those who don't know what IRA is, let's say what that is and who can have an IRA?
Right. That's a great question. We probably ought to define terminology. An individual retirement account is what an IRA stands for, and it literally is a person saving for their own retirement. There are permutations or derivatives of IRAs, so I've already introduced two of them. One is a Roth IRA. I'll come back to that in a moment. The other is known as a traditional IRA. And depending upon a person's income, how much it is, the source of it, so on and so forth, they might be able to put money aside for their retirement use. Retirement as defined by the government is age 59 and a half or older. I'll come back to that. And basically, the possibility of putting away this money and saving current year income taxes. So it reduces taxable income in the year in which you put it away for future use. That's the nutshell of a traditional IRA. Now, I did have a lot of caveats in there because this is the tax law. And anybody that would like to convince themselves of the horrible waste of trees that we call the tax code, just go ahead and try to pick one up Don't even bother trying to read through it. If you can lift it, you've already proven that you've got pretty good, strong muscles. But bottom line is it's extremely confusing because it's extremely conditional. So depending on a person's income, how much, depending on the source of that income, whether it's earned income, wages, or investment income, things like rental income, dividend income, interest income, so on and so forth. All of those things are conditions that play into two things. Number one, whether you, your spouse, or whatever, whether you're able to make a contribution to an IRA and how much. And then second of all, if we're talking about a traditional IRA, whether or not you're able to deduct that contribution from your current year taxable income.
And what would be a scenario when I could do that latter thing? I could make a contribution now and deduct it in last year's taxes. What would qualify me for that?
I would say for the vast majority of middle-income people, they could still contribute up to $6,000 into a traditional IRA account still this year, 2013, before they file their income tax for 2012, and reduce their taxable income from the year 2012 by that $6,000 amount. I would say that applies to most middle-income people who have a wage as opposed to income from things like investment property, income from dividends, interest, so on and so forth. So you've received a W-2 statement. That's a statement of wage earnings. If those wage earnings would put you in what I would refer to as a middle income type of individual, then that contribution limit to $6,000 could probably be achieved, and more than likely $6,000 total dollars could reduce that current year, 2012, taxable income.
Okay. We do have a question, a specific question, which we love to have here because Kevin can address your specific issues very well. So I'm going to read this, but first I want to remind you, if you do have a specific situation you want to ask Kevin about, this is free advice. He's here about every month. The number to call is 333-9455 or will-talk@illinois.edu. Okay, this person writes in, thanks for the program. A person's unable to call in but is listening online, wants to know, Kevin, do you have any advice about the accelerated mortgage programs that include a life insurance benefit? We are talking with a financial planner, and this is one of the things he suggested. Are there any questions we should ask or look out for? And he writes, from what I gathered, we pay the mortgage through this vehicle, plus a little extra for the insurance plan. The equity in the insurance plan builds up faster than the mortgage payment, and then you can cash the policy to pay off the mortgage. I might not have those details right, but is it something along those lines? Can you help him? He's listening in St. Joe.
That's a great question, but before I go too deep into what could be an answer, I would have to say many times I'll have to condition the response with, it depends.
And Kevin, hold on a second. He actually is on the line, I see. No, he's not. Okay, go ahead.
So let me begin with the disclaimer, it depends. A couple of thoughts I have. There's very good use for insurance products for insurable items. Example, property casualty insurance. We all carry insurance on our actions. So if you drive a car, that's an action that the state requires you to carry insurance on your actions. That's the requirement that you have liability insurance. So any harm you cause another party, there's financial, how should we say, substance behind the ability to repair some harm caused to others. Now, that's the principle of liability insurance. When we talk about things like insurance on a life, there's good purpose for that too. Life insurance, most easily thought of, should be thought of as income replacement insurance. So let's apply it to the question at hand related to a mortgage. If I'm going to take out a loan to buy a house, the mortgage is my pledge of the real estate as collateral in the loan. that's the security the lender is looking for, in addition to your income and your capacity to be able to make the payments over the 15 or 30 years or so on and so forth. I'm stretching a little bit to find a good use for an insurance product that has some buildup of cash value attached to the need to make a mortgage payment, which would lead me to surrender the insurance policy at some point in the future and capture that cash value to pay off the loan sooner. Now, that sounds like a bunch of stuff, and that's why I started out by saying it depends, and this is a little bit involved. But bear with me. I'll try to bring it to a close. I can see a good reason to have life insurance in place when debt is in place. So if there's an outstanding obligation called a mortgage loan on the purchase of a house, and something happens to the person who's making the payments, and that something is an untimely demise, referred to as the insurance people speak, then obviously a life insurance death benefit that would pay off the debt would probably be a nice thing to have in place. Now, there's very, very cost-effective term life insurance available for a person that has reasonable health. You don't have to have perfect health. But term insurance is like the insurance you put on your car. You pay a premium, the insurance period exists for 6 months, a year, whatever, and then you pay a premium again to keep the insurance in force. The difference between that and a whole life policy, or a derivative of a whole life policy that builds up cash value, is the following. That type of policy, the whole life policy or the cash value policy, has, in addition to a cost of pure insurance, an investment vehicle. And it's wrapped inside of an insurance contract, which gives it some tax preference. In other words, the buildup in cash value from an investment rate of return is not current year taxable income. So it's a little bit like investing within an IRA that, again, shelters the income or buildup in value from each year's taxes. But it's a very costly way to do what I think the sales agent is suggesting you do. So I would only say this. Look for alternative ways to accomplish the same goals that might be more cost effective.
Okay, we do have a caller from Champaign on line one. Joe, go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm self-employed and a woodworker. I bought a house several years ago specifically to move my shop into its enormous garage, and I have not inhabited that house at all. In fact, I've used part of it as sort of, shall we say, showroom, and for tax purposes, it's been pretty much a write-off because I live elsewhere. Now, this year, I'm about to remodel a portion of the house part of it and inhabit that, which will pretty much amount to just the kitchen and the bedroom. And my question is, how can I fairly and most beneficially relate this new circumstance in my tax application?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I would probably have to refer you to either a CPA very familiar with real estate and tax application in real estate, or perhaps even an attorney that does a lot of estate and real estate and tax work. You're probably wise to spend a little money up front and get good professional advice from either of those two, and it's the old penny wise, pound foolish if you don't. Here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that you might have an opportunity to look at the ability to deduct any interest expense on two mortgages if you called one a primary house and one a quote-unquote vacation house. But again, now I've just exhibited my ability to walk off the end of the plank, and that's as far as I prefer to do in this type of issue. So again, I'm gonna seek advice from somebody who's got a lot better insights in those areas.
Shall I take it from your answer that what you suspect would be the answer to my question is more complicated and or different than simply with regard to annual expense claims, taking it on a square footage percentage basis.
There may indeed be, how should we say, the percentage of use calculation that comes into play. So how much of it is related to a business and whether or not you file taxes as a self-employed business person? All of those things are the intricacies. All of those pieces are the little threads tying your question all together. So yes, I'm agreeing with what you just said. It depends is going to be very much at play here.
Okay. Thank you for your help. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Thanks for your call, Joe. And we'd like to hear from anyone who has a question about finance at any level. Call us at 333-9455, and you can talk to Kevin Wasby, who lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business. You can email will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also send your questions in at our Twitter account. We're at Focus580. We have a question, Kevin, for you. Let me just read it out here. It says, my husband and I are 60 and 59. We have around $175,000 saved for retirement. I will receive only Social Security at retirement, and my husband currently receives around $450 pension now and will retire at 62 on Social Security. I'm soon going to lose my job, which is half of our income, around $27,000 net per year. We owe about $17,000 on our mortgage taken out in 2003, and it was $170,000 principal at 5 1/8% interest. They're paying an extra $200 per month against principal, so our 15-year mortgage will be paid in January 2015, so 3 years early. The question, Kevin, is, should we go ahead and pay off the mortgage using money from our retirement fund, which will free up about $750 per month?
On the surface of things, I would say no, I wouldn't do that. And this might sound a little counter to what we talked about just a few moments ago. That bone in my body that's labeled thrifty is something that I'm alluding to here. It sounds like I'm the type of person that avoids debt at all cost, and that might be true, but again, here it depends. So here's what it depends on. Realize that the cost of servicing that mortgage, the monthly payment, is obviously a drag on your now soon-to-be smaller income. I understand that. But when money is withdrawn from the retirement account, that will be taxable money. Okay, so you'll have to pay tax on the distribution. That's going to kick up your income tax obligation in the year in which you do so. And you're basically paying off a debt that is going to cost you money to pay off. Does that kind of make sense if I think of it that way? It's going to cost me money to pay off the debt. Now, one of the reasons why I dislike debt is because if I look at paying off a debt, I'm looking at saving myself some hassle, some overhead, some burden, some something. And I realize that we're going to eliminate the monthly payment if we pull that money out in a lump and pay off all of the outstanding debt. But unless the monthly income is going to be insufficient to cover that obligation, in which case then we're basically forcing ourselves to rely on assets to retire a debt, I wouldn't do it. As a matter of fact, I might sound even silly if I were to suggest something like this. I'd quit paying extra on the mortgage. Now, I applaud you for retiring debt earlier than what the payments would have required you to do, the schedule of payments on the amortization of a 15-year loan. So I applaud you for doing that. But at this point, why pay extra is my question. You see, as long as there's sufficient income to cover that debt, in my opinion, I'd drag it out to the bloody end. I might even be as silly as saying something like, you know, if I could use my current income and current life situation and refinance the house, not to take a lot of money out of it. Don't get me wrong here. I don't want to create a lot of debt. But refinance the debt into a new 15-year loan that has $128 a month payments to pay off the existing principal, I'd rather do that. And again, You know, this sounds like I'm talking against that bone in my body that's, you know, the conservative, thrifty person. But what I'm trying to acknowledge is this. The mortgage loan is a contract you make. As long as you can satisfy the minimum payments on the table, that gives you maximum flexibility with what to do with your money. As soon as you pay that off, that flexibility is gone. The older you get and the lower your income goes, the less likely you will be able to borrow again.
So kind of what you're saying, I think I hear you saying, and we have a caller we'll get you in 1 second, Belden, use other people's money, pay less, and then, and if you can invest it at a higher rate.
No, I don't even want to go there.
Really? Okay,
no,
it's a totally different area.
I don't even want to go there. I'm saying interest rates are so stupidly low right now. Even the rate she mentioned of 5+%, which is high by
right.
today's standards. Mm. If I were to go get a new 15-year loan today, if I qualify based on income, that loan could be as low as 2.5%. Now, forget about what I'm going to earn on my money. That's not the argument here. Mm. The argument here is if somebody's going to give you their money with that cheap of a rate, and give you the amount of flexibility of keeping your money, A, in a retirement plan and not paying income tax on it, B, as a way of having discretionary disposable income every month, then I would basically say, forget about an earnings rate of return on your money not used to pay off the debt. Just, again, before the door closes, the door will close when your income falls sufficiently or your age rises sufficiently, you won't be able to borrow money again on a 15-year mortgage.
Right.
Okay? I like to keep doors open. I don't like to close them.
Good, good. We're going to take Belden's call in just a minute, but we have a break here, and we'll be right back with more Focus and Kevin Wasby.
Join WILL as we head north to Iceland for the adventure of a lifetime. I'm Mark Leonard, General Manager at WILL. This July, spend 8 days with us visiting Reykjavik, experiencing modern Scandinavian style, shopping, and museums, and taking in stunning views of the Icelandic landscape. There's also an option to extend your trip with a visit to Greenland. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or go online to will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
WILL programming is made possible in part by Sinfonia de Camera, presenting The Solar System on Saturday, February 16th at 7:30 p.m. at Cranert. Sinfonia takes off with Mio's La Création du Monde, hosts The Planets, and Matthew's Pluto the Renewer. More information is available at 333-6280.
All right, we're back with Focus. We're taking your financial questions with Kevin Wasby, who lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business. I'm your host, Kimberly Cronick. The number to call is 333-9455 or will-talk@illinois.edu. Or you can tweet us your question at Focus580. We have a caller on line one, Belden from Urbana. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Kim. You made reference to the very, very low interest rate. A lot of us who have 403Bs, 401Ks, or rollover IRAs have allocated a lot of our resources to bonds and to diversified bond funds. Now, as those interest rates go up in the future, we're going to get hurt by that. And some people have said, well, what you do if you don't want to go into the stock market, then you go into very short-term bonds. What do you think of that advice, and how do you do that? How do you know when to try to protect yourself against the increase in the interest rates in the future?
That's a great question on so many different levels. Wow, that's beautiful. Let me try to take pieces of it, and if I miss something, jump in and tell me I forgot an element of it, okay?
Okay, sure.
First of all, knowing the future, I don't know it. No one I know knows it. And if anybody comes to me at some point in the future and says, I know the future, I'm going to be really, really skeptical. So the point I would make is I have no idea when interest rates are going to go higher. But here's the intuitive aspect of where we're at. We are at all-time lows in interest rates. So let's see. If our Federal Reserve and most other central banks of developed economies have already instituted, and for the Federal Reserve's situation, now in its fifth year, has a zero interest rate policy basically in effect. Can they go any lower? And see, that's where I'm stretching to say, I won't guarantee it, but I'm thinking it's highly likely they can't go any lower.
I agree.
So then I'm going to have to say, well, I guess the only path they can take if they move, unless they stay here forever, forever is a long time. Sometimes I feel forever old, but I'm not quite. I'm close, but I'm not quite. But sometimes I'm going to have to say that the odds favor interest rates rising in the future. I'm not going to say when. I'm not going to say this year, next year, or the next 5 years. But I'm going to say I think the longer interest rates stay as low as they are, the closer we're getting to that eventuality. So here's what I'd say. Congratulations if you have not yet moved money to shorter-term bonds or shorter-term bond funds. But I'd say you're getting into the 11th hour of the party. Don't stay until the next morning. Now is as good a time as any, is what I'll say.
Really?
Yep, absolutely.
And would you move them, like if you have diversified bond funds, would you move them gradually into short-term, the whole thing into short-term? What would you do?
That's an excellent question again, so let me think about it this way. Since I don't know when or a certain date or at any point in the future or so on and so forth, I'd look at those movements similar to the way I looked at the way I funded those accounts. When you funded your 403B, every time the payroll office did their thing, a portion of your money was deferred and you invested into those funds. Let's take the same approach on the reallocation. Why don't we break that down over the coming 12 or 18 months and every month move 1/12th or 1/18th of the monies? You see, averaging into investments is something that many people are common or familiar with. Averaging out of investments works and provides similar benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does that help?
Yeah, it does. I mean, my worry was, you know, when do you do this? Now, you're going to get a lower return when you go into the short-term bonds, aren't you?
Exactly. But let's talk about relative, okay? So how much lower is what I'd like to look at.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just give a proxy. Right now, the yield on a two-year U.S. Treasury note is 27 basis points. That's 0.27%. On a 10-year, it's 2.03%. So obviously, I'm going to be cutting my current yield by a factor of 10.
Yeah, almost might as well go into cash reserves at that.
Well, but what I would tell you is this. The risk you expose your principal to is roughly 20 times greater in a 10-year instrument than in a two-year instrument.
Right.
So with any one of the funds that you might be in, and this applies not only to you or I, but anyone can do this. We can look at the mutual fund. We can look at the portfolio as to how it's structured. One of the measures in a fixed income mutual fund that's extremely helpful is what's called duration. Duration is the present value time-weighted term to maturity. Doesn't that sound like a mouthful?
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's what it means in terms of a very loose, rough rule of thumb. If that number is 2.5 as opposed to 12.5, 2.5 means if interest rates experienced an instantaneous 1% increase, the value of that fund would fall 2.5%. If the duration is 12.5 and interest rates experienced an instantaneous 1% rise, the value of that fund falls 12.5%.
Mm.
So now I'm looking at my buck being worth 87.5 cents versus 97.5 cents. Which picture do you like?
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the call, Belden. And I want to remind our listeners that you can call in now and ask a question of Kevin Wasby from the U of I College of Business. The number is 333-9455 or will-talk@illinois.edu or at our Twitter account, which is at Focus580. Kevin, we have a question that came in on our email. This refers to an earlier part of our conversation. The person wants to know, what are you referring to when you say middle income? In relation to deducting IRA contributions, I would like to know what range of income would qualify for the deduction. You mentioned a certain income level can deduct traditional IRA contributions, but can you also deduct Roth IRA contributions if within the middle income bracket? Also, could you explain the difference between traditional and Roth IRAs? Does your income bracket determine which you can contribute to?
Absolutely. Great questions. Let me start out by referring the person to the IRS website, irs.gov. Once there, go to the search box and put in Form 590. You'll get a PDF that's about 18 pages long that answers all of your questions and gives you links to other PDF files twice or three times as long. Welcome to the tax code. So without going through every question-answer series that we would need to do to specifically answer the questions this question brings up, you'll see very quickly that it depends on whether or not you or your spouse are covered by an employer-sponsored retirement plan. Then it further depends on whether or not you or your spouse have voluntarily contributed any money to that plan on top of what the employer may have done for you. Then it depends on what your adjusted gross income is for the year, both you or your spouse, or combined, depending on how you file your taxes, separately or married filing joint. Then it depends on what source that income came from, because depending on the form that you're forced to use to file your 1040, some of that income may appear on one line that doesn't hit AGI that you have to go back and make an adjustment to. Once we do all of these things, then I could answer your question. How much income, how much can I contribute, and how much may I be able to deduct? So I'm sorry to not be able to answer the person's question, but I hope they get a sense as to why, without asking, where is your income? Do either you or your spouse have an employer retirement plan? Are you actively participating? How much did you put in it? What was the source of the income? Which tax filing form are you using? Those are the questions that anyone would need to answer in order to get a concrete, how should we say, dollars and cents, yes or no answer to this question.
And what was the address again and form that you referred the listener to?
Sure. It's the IRS, how should we say, front door website, irs.gov, G-O-V. And once there, what you want to do is put in the search box form, F-O-R-M, like a tax form, 590. And the 590 form and instructions with it online each have links to all of those definitions. What is adjusted gross income? What type of income go into that or don't go into that? What is the qualification of income for a married person? What is the AGI limitation for deductions, so on and so forth. All of those things are in there.
Great. So if you have a question for Kevin, financial, you can again call in right now. We have a few minutes, about 10 minutes left, 333-9455 or will-talk@illinois.edu. This is Kimberly Cronick with Kevin Wasby. Kevin, as I hear you answer questions that come in either through our email or through the phone, I realize that the situations are so specific, and there's always follow-up questions that you have of the questioner. So it brings me to this question. Who needs a financial advisor? And if I were to get one, what should I look for? How do I know who is a good one? Is there ways of rating these folks? How much should I expect to pay? How do I be intelligent about identifying someone who I might want to have as a financial advisor?
Very good question. And again, like a broken record, it depends.
Okay.
I'd like to start you out with why that's a good disclaimer right up front. There's a lot of old sayings in the money business, and here's one of them. Do you want to eat well or do you want to sleep well?
What about both?
Well, yeah, you'd like to have your cake and eat it too. So when it comes to things like managing your financial affairs, first of all, I believe in empowerment. Isn't that a word that we like to champion about today?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, well, empowerment only comes with education. If you don't have either the, desire or the, enthusiasm, or less politely, if you don't have the ambition to educate yourself a little bit about the use of your money, basic economics. And I'm not talking about a course. I'm talking about basic money management skills, spending money, saving money, so on and so forth. Then hire a planner to do it for you. You see, if I don't want to know anything about the PC on my desk, and every time a browser freezes up, I am totally lost, then I'll hire someone to come in and fix my computer every time Internet Explorer freezes. Otherwise, I educate myself a little bit about the troubles that are causing it. I don't want to know how to get inside the box. I don't want to know how to reprogram software. I only want to look for those things that are important to me in those common use, common occurrence situations. So let me beat the stone really, really hard here for financial literacy. If you're not either engaged, interested, or ambitious enough to be moderately literate about finance, then hire a planner. It's that simple. How do we hire a planner? Just like you hire a doctor or an attorney. Ask someone for a personal reference. There's no better way to get in front of a professional that you trust than finding other people have done so and trust them.
Great. And you bring up a great point about financial literacy. What should we be teaching our children to help them be financially literate as they grow? I don't know if you have children, what you've taught them, or what would you give? What kind of advice could you give for that? How should we prepare kids to be interested in finances, to be empowered, and how do we start that in the home?
Well, I think it starts like everything else in an educative process. It starts at an early age, but answering your question, yes, we have one 22-year-old son. He's cheaper than I am. So I feel like I'd give him an A-plus in financial literacy. I think it boils down to the understanding of basics, and one of those basics I've already, disclosed. If I spend money today, I'll never have it to do anything with tomorrow. From an early age, I think we ought to, imagine that there's a future and then act like we are going to have to need things to survive in that future. So from the time he was 9 or 10 years old, I encouraged him to, help neighbors and be paid for it. So he was cutting lawns, shoveling snow, a lawn service that might charge someone $50 to roll a piece of equipment off of a trailer, buzz around for 12 minutes, and load it back up and leave. It took him a half an hour to do with a hand mower, and they were paying him $3, $4, maybe $5. But that $5 to him, and putting it in a savings account, and being able to take at as much as 20 or 30% of it to do with it as he wishes, I think set the stage for early learning. And I think it set the stage for a lifelong habit of being a little bit thrifty. So he grew up in a family with somebody that already had those bones in their body. I mean, I'm driving a 14-year-old car every day. I wouldn't mind having something new and flashy, but I've chosen not to. So how does a person do this? Like every other process in life, sit down, set an objective, break it into executable pieces, and then just worry about the small pieces rather than the big, unachievable lump.
We are talking with Kevin Waspy here on Focus, who lectures on finance at the University of Illinois' College of Business. Good morning. I'm Kimberly Cronick, here to take your calls for Kevin and your emails at will-talk@illinois.edu or 333-9455. You can email us also at our Twitter account, Focus580. We have about 7 minutes left. Kevin, let me ask you a question about those of us who are university or state employees who have pensions, who are, you know, have been in this system a while. We know that the laws are going to be changing. What advice do you have? Can you give any advice about folks who are in the pension system now? What things should they be looking for?
Well, that's a good question. So, again, like the broken record I am, it depends. Some of us in the state retirement system are in a system that's a defined benefit pension plan. Some of us are in a self-managed defined contribution element of it. So obviously those things have to be addressed separately. It depends on what a person has elected in that process. For the people in the defined benefit plan, I guess we're basically in a wait and see, because unless or until the General Assembly does anything with change in the pension laws, the pension rules, and the way they're written, and then all of the what happens if those rules happen to be in conflict with the state's constitution and the lawsuits that will come after all of those changes. You know, I'm starting to wonder if I'll already be past the point of drawing a retirement and now into the next life when all of that hits the, how should we say, settles to the ground. So I don't mean to sound, flippant. But I would say that there are so many more unknowns about anyone in a state pension plan now, the defined benefit part, the defined benefit elements of a state pension plan, that all you're doing is causing needless ulcer and worry. So if there's anything you want to do about it, stay informed, see what your legislators are or are not doing, stay plugged into the system's communications, whether it's SERS for state employees of university functions, or the teacher's retirement system for a public school, grade school, high school teacher, whatever. Stay attached to the information flows from those sources and see what is or is not being proposed.
And what if you are in that other category where you have a defined contribution? Is there anything to consider if you're in that situation?
No, I don't see any changes needed there at all, and probably a lot less need to make, attentive to change in laws, because those plans were set up in part to alleviate some of the pressures that are now being very obviously seen in the defined benefit plans. So those plans and the monies in them are, I would say, separate issues that are totally unrelated in most ways to this discussion.
We do have a question here. This person writes, I am in my late 30s, married, about to have my first child. What advice would you give me in terms of money management and the future of my child?
Again, some of the things that we've been talking about, save more rather than less. Hopefully the certainties of life bring you happiness rather than unhappiness, but we need to plan for that potential. Some of the things that could be disruptive to the plans that you set, whether it's for yourself, your spouse, your family at large, so on and so forth. So things like this. Do you have a good job? And hopefully, do you do a good job and have the opportunity to advance in the organization or within the industry? Those are things that sound like unrelated to the fact that you're having your first child. They're not. They're very related, because a lot of your capabilities in those day-to-day endeavors and the rewards you reap from them are going to be those things that allow you to provide for your children. So thinking of your career goals and doing your best effort every day you do your job is a great thing for your children too. Some of the things about insurance that an employer provides. So disability income insurance is a benefit that maybe you were not interested in the past, but with a child, you have an additional obligation. Talk with your employer's human resource people. That's what they refer to personnel people now. See if disability income insurance makes sense for you. If your employer doesn't provide it, then a possible independent insurance agent. The reason I say that is as follows. If we get sick or disabled and we can't work, income goes away. Duh, I've got a kid.
Great. Okay, we have just 3 minutes left. I do want to get this last caller in. So, caller, I'll ask you to state your question as succinctly as you can, and Kevin to answer as succinctly as you can. Jan from Urbana Line 1, go ahead, please.
I have a 28-year-old son working for a whole year in the EU. He's in Austria. I don't know what his income is, but he's still a citizen here. You know, his home address is in Urbana. So does he need to file income tax, and or who do I go and ask about this?
Yeah, I would say. Well, again, the answer depends. Depends on who he's working for, how he's being paid, and whether or not they're withholding U.S. income taxes. If he's still a U.S. citizen, then he's going to have a tax implication. That implication could have been handled by virtue of paying tax to a foreign government and at least getting a partial credit against U.S. income taxes owed. So you can tell already that it's a little bit complicated, so I would talk with a tax professional. If you want to field the question with a person at H&R Block, if you wanted to do something, you know, it's a beginning point. It may not be a simple process where the first person you ask is, how should we say, the person that's going to prepare the tax return. Have you talked with your son and asked him that question?
Probably do that, because that might solve one of the problems. It's just a private, you know, an industry that I don't know what they're doing with the money.
Right, and until you ask your son and he basically asks his employer for help, that's an unexplored opportunity. So I'd encourage you to ask him that. And if he doesn't know those answers, to go to his employer's HR people and ask them. If it's an institution that employs people internationally, I'm sure they have a very good staff of people that answer those questions.
Well, great. Thanks for your call, Jan. We do have to wrap up this edition of Focus. I do want to thank Kevin Waspy. He lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business. Please leave us your thoughts and comments about today's Focus program and on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus, or you can always email them to will-talk@illinois.edu. Focus is repeated each weekday night at 8 p.m. on WILL AM 580, in case you want to listen again. Monday's show, Craig will talk about women's health with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. That's Monday on Focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey, Jim Meadows, Craig Cohen. I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Auditory Care Center, an independent hearing care center serving Champaign, Piatt, Ford, Vermilion, and other East Central Illinois counties. Auditory Care Center offers hearing evaluations as well as selection, fitting, and repair of hearing aids at 892-5959 in Rantoul.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where wheat futures are higher today after recent declines boosted by technical buying and positioning before a long weekend. Monday is President's Day. The market closed until the evening. Wheat futures have fallen for most of the last couple of weeks, and that was pressured by negative technical signals, as well as weakness in corn and soybean prices and improving weather for winter wheat crops in the U.S. plains. Wheat is higher today, and soybeans and corn are higher today as traders see the recent sell-off as overdone. Let's look at particulars. In Kansas City, March wheat at 776 up 1. July 795 and a quarter up a quarter. March wheat in Chicago, 738 and three quarters up 6 3/4. July 748 and a quarter up 4 1/2. March corn, 699 up 4 1/4, now a half. July, 686.5, up 4.25, and December at 564.75, up 1. March soybeans, 1424.75, up 6.75. July, 1405.5, up 6.25. November at 1265, and they are up 0.25. March soybean meal, 409.30, up 2.10. The May is up 260 at 408.80. March soybean oil, unchanged on the day at 51.70. May, 52.09, down 2 cents. February live cattle, 126.30, up 40. April, 130.20, up 42.5. March feeder cattle, 143.27.5, up 60. And April lean hogs are 84.10, and they are down 22.5. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. It's 11 o'clock Central Time.